So now we are slowly going in a direction that we really get 3D data, 3D images, and so forth. And dense motion estimation, here are based on slides from other people. So if you want to see the original, you can have a click at these links and see where some of that stuff comes from. Okay, so what do we want to speak about today? Dense motion estimation means the following. So given is not only an image, but let's say a complete video, or at least two successive frames from a video. And what we want to compute now is something that the human eye or the human brain does very easily, and that is to compute for every pixel how that moves from one image to the next. Yeah? So if we have a car, for instance, here that is moving, it is very simple for a human observer to say that entire car moves a little bit. So every pixel here, or every pixel of that car, is moving in a certain direction. Yeah, and this is dense motion estimation, because we do not only compute the motion for particular features, yeah, for corners or so, we really want to compute a motion estimate for every pixel in our image. Yeah? And this would be a possible result, because that image now really shows a little arrow, a little vector for every pixel of our image, or at least of a part of that image with that car. And the arrow depicts the estimated motion of that pixel, yeah, from one frame to the next. And I mean, you already heard quite a bit. Of course, if we could compute that flow here, or in that example, yeah, the flow really comes from a motion of the car. But if the motion, for instance, comes from moving a camera, if we could compute the motion perfectly, we would already have a depth estimate. Yeah, this would give us depth information. But yeah, in that example here, the camera is still and the objects are moving, so that's also an interesting thing. Yeah, if you want to find moving objects, for instance, for autonomous driving, that's something that is very important. Yeah, but here the other example. Here again, we have an image, and in fact, that's just a frame of a little sequence that maybe you've seen before, because it's very often used in computer vision. And that frame is a static scene, but the camera moves. Yeah? And now this is such an example. If for this scene here, yeah, if the camera moves, then objects also move in the scene. And the closer they are to the viewer, the faster they move. So if we have a perfect motion estimate, yeah, from that information, we can derive depth. Yeah? So dense motion estimation does also work to compute depth, but that's not the only application. Yeah, it's also used to find moving cars, objects, and stuff like that. Yeah, and the difference now, or the important thing, we want to compute that densely. That means really get an estimate for every pixel in our image, and not only for a few feature points. Okay, and of course, you might quickly say, okay, that problem is sort of, yeah, under constraint. Yeah? So for instance, if we look at that example, so that's a rotating plate and a Rubik's cube on it. Yeah? So when that plate rotates, it is clear that the cube here also rotates, and we have quite a few features where we see the rotation. Yeah, but for the white plate here, yeah, this is completely untextured. So we assume it rotates, because in the video, the cube rotates, and here this part also rotates, but in fact, we don't really know for that white plate. It doesn't change from image to image. Yeah, we can just assume that it also moves. Yeah, and this, of course, now is a problem for these dense methods, yeah? Because it cannot really distinguish or find out that this is part of a larger thing, so that plate rotates. Yeah? And so a normal dense estimation, motion estimation algorithm here we'll say, okay, that plate does not move and that cube moves, and here the surrounding, that part of the cylinder, that also moves. Yeah, but the white plate has no features, so we cannot detect its motion. Yeah, so that makes dense motion estimation an interesting problem, because we also for the cars, yeah, we have parts here. Here we have parts that have no textures, that are plain white, so we can only guess because its surrounding moves. Yeah, probably that part also moves, so we have to propagate that information. Yeah, from feature points also to surfaces where we don't have such features, and yeah, this is what we will speak about today. Also a few little introductions about motion estimation. Motion is very interesting because the human eye is very good in detecting motion. Yeah, so it seems to be a very simple problem for us, but if you want to implement it on a computer, you will see that it is not. And one example how good the human eye is in detecting motion, if you look at that one, at that image, yeah, you see that this is a completely random pattern, but there's a square here which is moving left and right. And this is, for a human observer, that's very simple to recognize. Yeah, because we're very trained to detecting such moving patterns, and we also quickly see that this is a square that is moving back and forth. Even if every single picture, yeah, in every single frame, yeah, it looks completely random, but as soon as things move, we immediately see that, that square in that example. Another example is this here. Yeah, this looks like a random set of points, yeah, or rather random. But if we animate it, you can immediately recognize what it is. Yeah, that's a walking human. I hope everybody of you saw that. Yeah, so it's only the motion gives us all that information. Yeah, and it's very abstract. Yeah, in the still. Yeah, I think nobody recognized at that moment that it's a human. Yeah, but as soon as it's walking, yeah, I think it becomes immediately clear. Okay, and now motion detection has also problems. Yeah, so one is that usually in an image we only see part of reality. So if we have a situation like this here, so we have an object just moving to the right. Now, let's say with our camera, we only see a part of that image, like this here. Yeah. If we now look at that, we see this. Now it moves to the right, but our impression is, yeah, it doesn't move to the right, it moves to the upper right. Yeah, because that's the kind of for us, most plausible way that this object moves. Yeah, we don't see how that looks in reality. Yeah, so the brain does a lot here, and there's a lot of intuition in it, and a lot of making things plausible, and a lot of assumptions. But it's difficult to describe that. Really, what is the best solution? What is the right solution for that one? Yeah, so here we see the difference. Okay, and another example. Yeah, so obviously another example for this aperture problem. Yeah, so obviously what we see here is a stripe pattern, yeah, that seems to run from the upper left to the lower right. If we look at the entire scene, yeah, we see that this is a pattern, yeah, which is here on a pole, which is rotating. Yeah, so in fact, it's a rotation. Yeah, so essentially the movement happens from left to right, but here it looks like it moves from the upper left to the lower right. Yeah, again, the same principle. And other examples, other problems, yeah, that motion, real motion, yeah, or that what we see optically, optical flow that we see in an image is not necessarily the real motion of an object. So if we take that example here, yeah, a glossy sphere, which is reflecting light. Yeah, so here we see a reflection of the sun, for instance. Now, if that sphere rotates, yeah, nothing happens in the image. Yeah, the reflection of the light stays at the same position and the sphere rotates underneath. So we have no optical flow, but obviously we have motion flow. And on the other hand, if we move the light source, yeah, then suddenly the reflection moves. So we have an optical flow, but no real motion, at least not motion from the sphere. Yeah? So we often mix optical flow and motion flow, yeah, and assume that if there's an optical flow in the image, this comes from a motion flow. And in many situations, that makes sense to assume so, but it's not always the case. Yeah? That's what we should be aware of. Okay. Other assumptions, yeah? Often we assume that if we have an optical flow in an image, yeah, as I said, we assume that's also a motion in reality, and that all pixels of an object, yeah, move by the same amount. So if we have a car here, and that car moves from left to right, yeah, every pixel here moves with the same speed. Yeah, it moves by the same amount from image to image. But of course, this is only true if the car moves in parallel to the image plane. Yeah, if, or this is a simplified assumption, if we take, for instance, as an example, that cube here, yeah, that also moves in the same way, but you see, due to perspective, yeah, more happens. So, for instance, that side here gets occluded and that side becomes visible, and in fact, the points here on front of the cube move faster than those in the back. Yeah? So we cannot assume that our motion field is sort of constant in large areas. There are subtleties, yeah, so that it can vary also over objects. Or an even worse example, yeah, a situation if you have that car approaching you, yeah, and you look at the optical flow here. Yeah, what happens is that the objects move outwards, yeah, like in an explosion. You have very different motion vectors here, and in fact the optical flow vectors, but the motion goes towards you. Okay, and one thing that is also to be considered, a camera rotation does not automatically mean that your image is only rotated. It does more complicated things due to perspective. So if we have that example, yeah, that's a picture of a rectangle, maybe of a window or of a board. And now if we rotate the camera, yeah, there's also distortion happening. Yeah, even if the object is static, but in image space, a distortion is happening. Yeah, and the optical flow looks more complicated than only a constant movement. Okay. Oh, sorry. That should have gone. good. So let's look at that problem. Yeah, and let's start slowly. Yeah. So let's start with a very simple instance of our problem, and that is image alignment. And the goal is the following. So let's say we have two images. Yeah. Obviously, the camera has moved in between. In fact, it moved quite a bit. So you see that screen here moved from here to here in the image. And now we want to compute an optical flow in the sense that we want to compute a single translation so that these images fit together as good as possible. Yeah. So we do not compute per pixel optical flow, but really flow for the entire image. Yeah, we compute a single translation vector V so that in the overlap region, yeah, the images are as similar as possible. That's a simplified version of optical flow. Yeah, and of course, later on, we will refine that so that we get really pixel-wise. Okay, yeah, this is now a good example for introduction. It makes things easier. And of course, there are also applications for that. For instance, mosaicing. So what we see here is a set of images that have been taken here from a little airport, obviously. Yeah. And these are a set of images taken maybe from a flying plane or from a drone or whatsoever. And the task now is to merge these into a larger image. Yeah. And yeah, this is what we get here. Yeah, this is, we take all the images and find the optical flow between them so that we can stitch them to one single image. And of course, now many of these assumptions or problems that I explained before are not met here. Yeah, that due to perspective, for instance, it changes and so on. Yeah, so that's a very simplified way to look at that problem. Okay, good. So what would be applications? Yeah, the assumption is that the entire image moves. For instance, this can happen due to movement of the camera, that the camera is installed on a plane which flies constantly, or that we make a movie and we have camera shake. Yeah, because while we film that movie, we are walking. Yeah, so the images go up and down, and what we want to compute now is a kind of stabilization. Yeah, we want to compute how the images shake from frame to frame. Yeah, so that we can compensate for that. That would be another application. Okay, and another application would be that we want to find moving objects in our scene. Yeah, so we assume that we have a static background and we have an object in the front. Yeah, and we want to find out that there's an object moving and how fast it moves. Now we have the problem that the optical flow is not constant, but we can probably rather easily identify foreground and background and separate these two and compute the optical flow only on the moving object. So this requires a separation of background and foreground objects. And this is a very well-known problem, background separation. There are different ways to do that or different ways to fine-tune that. The simple way is that we simply take the differences, or that we first take a single picture of the background without an object. Yeah, we then take our input stream, we take the differences, and then we say all pixels that are significantly different from the background without front object, yeah, we mark and say now this is our object. And of course there will be little errors in it. Yeah, so there will be, due to noise, for instance, there will be pixels marked even if they are the same, yeah, just due to noise. And others in the foreground object might happen to have a similar color like the background, so we get holes here. And so we still have to do some post-processing on these output masks to remove these little outliers here and here. Usually we do that using operations like erosion and deletion, which are very simple image space operators to get rid of that. And once we did so, we have a mask that really tells us the front object, and then we can do the motion estimation just on these masked pixels. Yeah. Okay, good. So much. Yeah. Why we also want to do a motion detection. Yeah, with a single vector. Yeah. And as I said, we will refine that. So we will come back to the real problem. Today. Good. So, how could we compute that? And yeah, probably that's not too difficult to find out how we could handle that or describe that mathematically and then find a solution. Yeah, so let's say given our two images, I0 and I1, yeah, and X in that case is just the pixel position. Yeah, X is a 2D coordinate And I0 of x is the color of that image at that position x. Yeah? And we have two images, I0 and I1. For now, or for all the rest, we assume that we only have black and white or grayscale images, not black and white, grayscale images. Yeah? So we have a single scalar value for every pixel, something between 0 and 1, or 0 and 255, if you prefer. And now the goal is we are looking for a displacement vector u. Yeah, that's this one single vector we are looking for now, such that I1 of x plus u and I0 of x are as similar as possible. Yeah, so we are looking for the translation between the two images, yeah, that minimizes the differences between the two images. And now the question is, how do we describe or measure the difference between two images? Well, the first simplest way probably is that we take all the image pixels of the translated image, yeah, and subtract the original image. We do that for all pixels. Yeah, in fact, we have to say for all pixels in the overlap region. Yeah, we do that for all pixels in the overlap region and sum the squares of these differences. Yeah, that would be probably the first way you would write down the problem. And in fact, now what we are looking for now is the vector u that minimizes this difference here. Yeah, which value u results here in a difference that is as small as possible. Okay, good. So that's our first way to describe. Yeah, we take the sum of squared differences. That what SSD stands for. And of course, if we, for color images, we could, for instance, extend the sum also over color channels and so on. We won't look into that for now. We only have grayscale images. Okay, now with sum of squared differences, yeah, we have, that works, but we will see that we also run into problems. The square function to measure error, the rationale behind this is that the larger the difference is, the more it should count. Yeah, so small differences should be acceptable, but if we have very large differences in two pixels, yeah, or in one pixel, if we have very large differences, yeah, that should get a large weight. Yeah, and we should try to find a use so that the differences in general are more small than large. Now the problem is that with these with a sum of squared differences, that large errors get very dominant, and that even if we have noise, yeah, the error from noise can become large. And now all these larger errors become dominant, and the errors, yeah, with smaller amount, yeah, do not count anymore. So an optimization, yeah, really only tries to align noise, for instance, yeah, which is not very good, yeah, and which turns out to make that entire thing not very robust. On the other hand, this square function here has the nice advantage that for minimization, at some point, yeah, we need an algorithm that computes, that performs this optimization, that delivers us the optimal u that minimizes this difference here. Yeah, we will come back to that later, how we do that minimization. And for doing that minimization, this metric here that measures distance is very good. Yeah, because it is differentiable. Yeah, and it leads to very nice formulas. So for optimization, it's very good. For practical reason, it turns out for images not to be the best way to measure distances. Okay, so we could look at others, yeah? And what could we do to measure, or how to avoid that the error increases, yeah, very much? Yeah, instead of squaring, we could simply take the absolute value of the difference. Yeah, so it increases linearly. Of course, larger errors are still get larger weight, yeah, but nevertheless, it doesn't grow so quickly, and in fact, this turns out to be more robust. This is not the sum of square distances, but the sum of absolute differences. And yeah, here you can see the corresponding curves. I mean, okay, that's an absolute value function. I hope you have seen that before. Okay, and now there are still, I mean, in fact, probably you already heard from other lectures that these two norms can be generalized to so-called LP norms. And in these LP norms, yeah, so here the idea is that we take the absolute difference and we take it to the power p, sum all these up, and then we take it to the power 1 over p. So if here we insert 1 for p, we get this norm. And if we insert 2 for p, yeah, essentially we get this norm with the only difference that this norm is just the sum of squares, and if from that one, if we sum for all pixels and then take the square root, we get the other norm. But the square root doesn't make a difference because we're minimizing anyhow. So if, yeah, whether we minimize the sum of square differences or its square root, it doesn't make a difference. Yeah, it leads to the same minimum. And now we might consider, okay, maybe we can use that, yeah, and try other values for p. So if we look at that closer, we will realize if we increase p, we increase the problems that we have with the sum of squared differences anyhow, yeah, because then the curves become even steeper. So for one, we said we got better results. So what we could try is that we try values smaller than one. Yeah, this gives us a curve like this here. And in fact, this can be done. Yeah, this also works. One thing that we should be aware of is that if p smaller than 1 is chosen, then in fact this is no longer a norm. But for our purposes here, yeah, it doesn't have to be a norm. We can simply ignore that. Just wanted to mention it here. And now if we look at that curve, essentially what does it tell us? It tells us, yeah, this norm here compares if two pixels are the same. If so, then we have no error. And if they differ, yeah, then the error first increases quickly, but then it increases slower. So whether two pixels have a difference of 10 or 20 doesn't make a big difference. Yeah, it mainly counts how many pixels are similar. And in fact, that works pretty well. And in fact, maybe we would make that even bring that even further. And if we could, no chalk here. Also not here. Okay. yeah. So if we could design that function here, in fact, what we maybe would like to have is something that is tolerating a certain difference between the two, just to allow noise between the two images. And then the curve should go up a little bit, but once they are so different, yeah, that we are pretty sure they don't show the same part of the scene, it should become constant again. Yeah, so this kind of approximates the shape, but what we would like to have is something like this. Yeah? Because whether two pixels differ by 20 or by 50 or by 100 doesn't make a difference, yeah, for us. So why not design that shape by ourselves? And in fact, this is also a variant. This is called so-called robust kernel functions. We could simply define a function that takes the difference between two pixels and then penalizes them in a way that we define, yeah? And a function that has this shape that I just described is, for instance, that kernel function here. It has a parameter a that tells us how wide this gap becomes. Yeah, so we could use that, for instance, to become more tolerant with respect to noise or other stuff. Yeah. And now we take the difference between two pixels. Yeah. We plug it into that function. And you see, if the pixels are the same, we have no error, of course. If they are similar, yeah, the error is still rather small. And if it grows, then the error becomes bigger. And at some point, then, yeah, it again converges. Yeah, just because I don't care whether the difference is 20 or 100, they are not the same at that point, and they should both penalize in the same way. And this again leads to more robust adjustment, and that's why it's called robust kernel function. Yeah. Okay, so you see, yeah, if we look at that more closely, yeah, there are different ways to describe already that very simple problem. Something else we should look at, but this is rather obvious and very simple to describe, I already mentioned so. Yeah, we should really only summarize or compute the difference for all pixels that overlap between the two images. Yeah, of course, for this example here, yeah, we should only look at the difference in the region where both images overlap. And of course, which region is the overlap region depends on the vector u. We should maybe also take care that we don't take a solution where the images don't overlap at all, yeah, where we take a u that is so far from apart that there's no overlap, and in that constellation, then the error would always be zero. Yeah, we summarize over all overlapping pixels. If there are no overlapping pixels, we get a zero error, which might be considered as a perfect solution, but of course it shouldn't be. Yeah, so we sort of have to describe that. And the way we can do so is that we take a windowed norm. Yeah. And we take two functions, w0 and w1, and yeah, they simply mask out the regions of interest. And for the simple problems, this function is 1 for the entire image and 0 outside the image, yeah, for image coordinates outside the image. But with these functions, we could also mask out regions of interest. If you remember that example with the background foreground extraction or segmentation, yeah, in these functions we could also add a moving person. Yeah, if we just want to window that person, we computed a mask for the person in both images, and now we take these masks as these functions here, and in fact now. This norm here simply also adds these window functions, so an error is only generated if these functions, both for the target image and for the source image, or the other way around, yeah, is used. Okay, and now this results in the problem that an offset function or an offset value u that is so big that there's no overlap, yeah. Is generated, and thus the error becomes zero. We can sort of normalize that by dividing by the number of pixels where this overlap here becomes one. Yeah, so we can simply count the pixels for which there's an overlap, and then normalize by this area. Yeah, so that an optimization is not tending towards separating these images as far as possible, because then the overlap becomes smaller, and only by that effect the error becomes smaller. Okay. Good. Then there are other things we could consider. One is bias and gain, and that means whenever we move our camera, for instance, and we have a camera with automatic exposure control. It can happen that from one frame to the next, the exposure time or the aperture are changing, and that the images, the image gets a little bit darker just for that reason. Yeah, not because something is moving, but just in general, the image gets darker from one frame to another, yeah, due to the exposure control of a camera. So how can we solve that? We would need a mapping between the two images. Yeah, we would need a mapping, for instance, for image I0 that maps brightness values from image I0 to those that are comparable with I1. And in fact, to do that, yeah, we would need a real mapping function, and we would need the camera response function of our camera. I think you also spoke about that. Yeah, so that we can really compute the mapping between the two. A very common way is simply to approximate that as a linear function here, alpha I0 of x plus beta. And we now, if we have these values alpha and beta, yeah, we can compute the difference here with this compensation. But in fact, of course, we don't know alpha and beta. So what we can do is that we simply take this formula here and then look for values of alpha and beta that minimize this norm. Yeah. So that means to compute the norm, we need a minimization, and this norm is part of a minimization. So we have a minimization within a minimization, which sounds like very long computation times. Yeah. But maybe we can also do this this computation only on a subset of our pixels or stuff like that, yeah, so that we can do that quickly enough. Yeah, and in fact, computing these values alpha and beta such that this error is minimized, yeah, this is a classical linear regression problem. So that can be solved in reasonable time. Okay, so yeah, that's one option, yeah, that we say, okay. It can happen from one image to the other, yeah, that exposure control changes things. Yeah, but maybe we have another way, yeah, to describe similarity, even if the absolute values are not the same, but at least, yeah, we can say if we have similar structures, yeah, and wherever one picture is bright, the other one is also bright, and where one is dark, the other one is also dark. Maybe we can measure that directly without computing these alpha and beta values. And in fact, what we also can do to measure similarity is to compute the cross correlation between images. And in fact, yeah, that's very simple. Instead of just counting the differences between two pixels, yeah, and summarizing the differences, we summarize the products. Yeah. And what we get here is a correlation. And so correlation is the opposite, sort of opposite of difference. That means the more similar the images are, the higher this value gets. Yeah. So here we don't need a minimization, but we want to maximize the correlation. And in fact, yeah, it is even if we have two images, or let's put it the other way. Let's say the images that there's no exposure control in between. Yeah. What happens here is that whenever one image has a large value and the other image has a large value, this combination becomes very large. Yeah. So this value here becomes particularly high in the regions where the overlap is good. Yeah. So if we have the same images in the overlap region, then this correlation value here becomes very high. Yeah. So that's an alternative to using the difference. Yeah. Instead of making the difference small, we can try to make the product large. And in fact, this even works. Yeah. If the images have not been taken with the same exposure, if the entire second image yeah, it's only half as bright. Yeah, we get here a factor of 1/2, but the optimization or a maximization still brings us to the same point. So in fact, yeah, the cross correlation can handle such problems here, yeah, that we have images with different exposure control, it can directly handle these. Yeah, and we don't have to compute these alpha and beta values. We can directly use the correlation. And even if the pictures have been taken, maybe even with different cameras or at different times of a day or something like that, the correlation still can give us or can guide the optimization into the right direction. And even better, it is to use a cross correlation where we don't a normalized cross correlation where we don't directly take these values here and multiply them, but instead we normalize the image values in the following way. We take for each image the average, that's this here, I0 with a bar, that's the average value. So we subtract that from here. So that means, oops, a value of 0 stands for an average color, positive values, yeah, are above the average, negative values are below the average. Yeah, and we compute the cross correlation between these, because what now happens, yeah, if one is positive and the other one is positive, yeah, this gives a large correlation. If one is positive and the other one is negative, this gives a negative correlation, yeah, and this is exactly the case that we want to avoid. Yeah, one pixel bright, the other dark, then this reduces the correlation, and if both are negative, yeah, due to the multiplication it becomes big again. Yeah, so that's a very neat mean to compute correlations between images where we don't have absolute radiance values or something like that, yeah, where we don't really have physically measured values, yeah, but we just know if the value is larger, then it's brighter, and if it's small, then it's darker, and we have two images that might look very different, but we can still find a correlation between the two and use that for optimization. Okay, good. Yeah, so this also works with pictures, when pictures were taken with different exposure or other differences. Okay, so this was, yeah, different variants for measuring the difference in the overlap region. Yeah, so you saw a number of error metrics. Now the remaining problem is, how do we search the U value? Yeah, the offset that minimizes the error between the two, or in the case of cross correlation that maximizes, yeah, or take just minus the cross correlation and then we are fine again. Okay, that's another problem, and it's sort of independent of the error metric. Yeah, so the problem is, how can we compute values for U? Yeah, maybe in a limited radius that we say, okay, from picture to picture, we only allow a displacement of 50 pixels or something like that. Yeah, but within that radius, we still have many possible values for U. Yeah, which one is the right? And of course, yeah, the first variant is we make a full search. Yeah, we test every possible offset. Yeah, within a radius of 100, there are something like 200 by 200 pixels, which is a lot, yeah, because even for each of these offset vectors, we have to compute the difference, which we have to do for every pixel, yeah, in every image. So only evaluating that error metric, yeah, is already rather expensive because we have to look at every pixel. Yeah, and then for doing that for many possible values for U, yeah, that's expensive. Of course, it would deliver us, at least with a precision of one pixel, the optimal value, but maybe we should try to find a better solution. And a very simple solution, which is necessary to make that work in practice, is to use an image pyramid. I'm just thinking, have you spoken about image pyramids in the lecture here before? No? Okay, good. I mean, there's not so much to explain, yeah, but it's a concept that is used very often. And the idea is the following. So here you see two frames, yeah, of that sequence I've already shown in the beginning. Yeah, so you see the camera moves a little bit, and as a result, here the tree trunk moves in the image, yeah, because it's close, it moves more, and in the background, the background moves less. And now we want to do that computation here on that image, on these two images. And as I said, this is costly. But what we could do is the following. We simply take downsampled versions of that image. That just means we generate versions of that image with decreasing resolution. Yeah, and usually the easiest way to do that is to halve resolution from image to image simply by always computing the average of 2 by 2 pixels, and this gives a new value for a new pixel. Yeah, and if we do that multiple times, we get very blurry, low resolution versions of our image here. Yeah, but if you look at that image, the motion still is visible in that image. Yeah, and because the resolution is so low, yeah, here it's within one pixel, or the movement is only, yeah, one pixel or a few pixels, just because the resolution is so low. So what we could do is that we simply take that image, yeah, and first compute the motion on these two images, yeah, in that low resolution, because the resolution or the pixels are much bigger. We need a much smaller search radius in units of pixels. Yeah, the search radius is smaller, and the images have lower resolution, so evaluating the metric is also much cheaper. Yeah, so on these images, we can do a sort of full search. Yeah, but full really only means looking at a rather few translation vectors. And once we have that, we found that, yeah, we go to a finer resolution and only refine that solution that we found before. Yeah, so we take the vector, that large vector that we found in the first step, and from here on, again, we make a full search, but now again with a smaller radius, just to refine that vector. Yeah, and we can continue. Yeah, if once we found the solution now in that image, we go to that image, yeah, and refine that vector even further, and in the end, we do that in full resolution. Yeah, of course, this does not guarantee that we find the global minimum. Yeah, but at least it works very well in practice, and it is much faster. In fact, it's the only way to do that in a practical manner. Yeah, unless we have a very small search radius. Okay, so using an image pyramid, yeah, is the key how we can solve that problem here in that context. Yeah, and here again is how that how that looks like, or a little illustration. So we take the two images. Yeah, then we compute an image pyramid, in that example, a Gaussian pyramid. Here, that just means that from pixel or from image to image, or these downsampled versions are not generated by a 2 by 2 box filter, as I described before, but by a more complex Gaussian filter. Yeah, so that is called a Gaussian pyramid. And now we compute the offset, or we make a full search first starting here on the coarse resolution. And now if we say here we have a search radius, for instance, of 10 pixels, yeah, here on that stage of the pyramid, this is only 1.25 pixels. Yeah. So we can make a full search, yeah, with search radius 1.25 pixels. Yeah. So that's a very small search radius. And in fact, we have to round, or we will round to complete pixels, to integers. Yeah, so probably we only have plus minus 1 in that case. Yeah, so we estimate u. Then, yeah, we continue here, start with that value, and only take a smaller search radius so that we only update with respect to the one before. And if the resolution always halves, yeah, that's essentially then only a search radius from minus 1 to 1. Yeah, so only 9 possible positions are examined. And then we continue until we are at the bottom resolution. Okay, so that animation is a little bit screwed up, but I think you know what I mean. Okay, so is that clear so far? Yeah? So what we obtain now is an estimate in pixels, in single pixels, yeah, or in integer pixel values. So we say, okay, we assume this pixel was moving with respect to the first frame, 5 pixels to the right and 3 to the top. Yeah? But if we look at that example, for instance, here in the lower right, yeah, obviously, so there's movement going on here from the tree trunk that, again, as humans, we perceive. But if we closer look at it, we see that this movement mainly happens because sort of these pixels change their color. Yeah, it is not that a pixel is completely bright and then becomes completely dark. Yeah, the movement here happens, is only a subpixel movement, but we can still see it. Yeah, because at the silhouette, on the left, pixels become brighter, and on the right, they become a little bit darker. Yeah, so obviously humans can perceive it. So maybe we can even find movement, yeah, in subpixel range. And in fact, that works. And the nice thing is that's rather simple to compute. Or it's not very simple, complicated to compute. And we can simply do that as a second step after the one we saw up to now, because up to now, since we do a full search, yeah, we only have integer movements. And now we can also try to add subpixel movement to this value of u. Yeah? So how could we do that? In fact, that's not very complicated. So what we do is the following. We make a Taylor approximation on our image, yeah? And we do a very simple Taylor approximation, a first order approximation. And that means the following, yeah? So let's say we have our image, I1, we already computed the offset vector u, and now we want to add another delta u, yeah? This delta u is a subpixel value, yeah? It's smaller than a single pixel. Yeah, really some chalk would be great. is it on the screen? Okay. So, yeah, we have here our pixel grid. And now we found out, okay, from one image to the next, yeah, We estimated this u vector, yeah? And now we also want to add a little delta u within the single pixel, yeah? So this is smaller than a single pixel. And of course, we cannot compute such a delta u with a full search. That would mean that we take the space of double or floating point numbers, yeah? That would be far too much. Yeah, but how could we really do the final fine tuning, the final fine adjustment, yeah, so that the images maybe even better overlap, yeah. And this also accounts for another problem, and that is, that's not here a problem. Sorry, forget that. Okay, so how could we do that? We take the original image, yeah, with the offset u, and then we pre-compute or do a little pre-computation. We say, okay, so this pixel, this here, is I1 of x, yeah? And x is the pixel coordinate, yeah? Or in our example, it's even x plus u, so it's already the offset image, yeah? Okay, if we now move a little bit to the right, yeah? How much does that image color change? Well, if we say that every pixel has uniform color, yeah, then of course it doesn't change. If I go from the pixel center here to the right, yeah, then the pixel color doesn't change. It doesn't change until I come to the next pixel. But we said we want to have subpixel precision. But what we could do is that we say, okay, between pixels, yeah, we do a linear interpolation. So our color does not look like this. So these are our pixels. Yeah, and we don't say that the brightness values, yeah, define this here, yeah, or are piecewise constant, but instead we do a linear interpolation like this, yeah. Okay, that also makes sense, yeah. And what we say now, okay, if I move a little bit to the right here, how much does the color change? Well, it just changes by, if we take that value, yeah, and we say, okay, here, this is the next pixel, so I just take the difference, plus 1, minus, yeah, and this times delta u, yeah, so if delta u becomes 1, yeah, the difference is just the difference between the two pixels, and if we are on half the way, yeah, it's half the difference between the two, yeah. So essentially, yeah, if we say, okay, I go by some delta u, and in fact delta u is a vector, goes into x and y direction, yeah, I can approximate the new color by simply adding delta u times these values. And the same in y direction. So here we need a vector in x direction and a vector in y direction. Yeah, and this a scalar product with delta u x and delta u y. Yeah, this is going in x direction and in y direction. And in fact, this is simply the gradient in this image, yeah, or the Jacobian. Yeah, and this is the Jacobian of our image at the position x plus u. Yeah, this is nothing else but the gradient here. Yeah, and the what this then in the end becomes is a linear Taylor approximation. Yeah, and this is what we see here. We simply say, okay, if we go delta u to the right, then we have the original value plus delta u times this here. Yeah. And this is the gradient or the Jacobian here in that example. Yeah, so that's a simple first order Taylor expansion. And in fact, this expansion is very good because we only look at subpixel step sizes. Yeah, so only we only go to the right or to the left. Yeah, by a rather small amount. Yeah, so we are usually or generally here on such linear parts, yeah? Okay, now that's trick number one, yeah? So we use this Taylor expansion. And now, yeah, we can decide about how can we compute J1. So in that example, yeah, I computed it using a forward difference because we walked to the right and then subtracted that value. Of course, I can also do that backwards, or I can use a central difference. I go forward one step and backward one step and take the difference there. Yeah, and that's generally the symmetric variant, which is the one to be preferred. Okay, so yeah, we can compute that Jacobian. So that's just a simple pre-computation on our image. And then going delta x to the right or moving by delta x, yeah, with that term, we can directly compute how much the color changes. Yeah? So we pre-compute that J1 of x for our image, and then we can very quickly, for a given delta x or delta u, yeah, we can quickly see how much the image changes. Okay, and in fact, this now boils down to the method of Lucas Canade, yeah, which is, as you see, pretty old. And this does the following. Yeah. So let's say we already have an offset vector u given, and now we want to refine that by some subpixel delta u, yeah, or by a small value delta u. So the error now is I1 of xi plus u plus delta u minus I0 of x1, xi. Yeah. So here this is this additional delta u. Now for this, we take this approximation using the Jacobian. And now you see I1, this difference here is constant. It's independent of delta u. So we describe this as ei. And what remains is this part here. Yeah. And now we are looking for the delta u that makes this difference as small as possible. Yeah, that minimizes this sum here. Yeah, this part here becomes constant now. So this also can be pre-computed. And we are only looking for the du that minimizes that here. And yeah, now this is a nice optimization problem. Yeah. And probably you heard about optimization in another context already or in other lectures. If not, also no problem. Yeah, this now boils down to something which we will use very regularly. We have the following scenario. We have a matrix given. In our case, that's this Jacobian. Yeah, this has a row for every pixel and is two columns wide. Yeah, two columns because it's the derivative in x and y. And for every pixel, yeah, we have the Jacobian. Yeah, so we take all the pixels and write them in a big matrix. Yeah, so this has a lot of columns. No rows, sorry. Yeah, maybe 1 million or so. And we have that vector b, yeah, which is this e term from here. This e here, the difference, yeah, that is there without delta u, yeah, so that's the difference. And this one we call residuum. Okay, and now we can say the remaining error is this matrix A times delta u, yeah, so this is a matrix product, A times delta u, minus b, minus this residuum, this is just this formula here. Yeah, and in fact, I think this should be minus and not plus. Yeah, it depends on in which direction you measure the difference. Yeah, but the plus or minus is not important. Yeah, so we compute that and take the sum of squared differences. Yeah, and this is our total error. And we have matrix A given, we have B given, and we are looking for delta U such that this sum of squared differences becomes minimized. Yeah. And now this is a typical linear least squares problem, right? Okay, so this is a least squares problem, yeah, because we are looking for We make a minimization, yeah, so that the squares of the differences are minimized, and such problems can be solved, yeah, in the following way. I mean, it's really you don't need to be able to reproduce these formulas in an exam, yeah, just to show the idea behind that. So this here, we can rewrite in the following form. Yeah, this is something like a minus b squared. Is a squared minus 2ab plus b squared. Of course, this is only for real numbers. If we do that with matrices, yeah, so this is this a minus b squared. If we do all these multiplications with matrices, the a squared becomes this term, yeah, delta ut at a delta u, yeah, that's this part squared, minus the mixed term, 2 delta ut at b, yeah, plus this part squared. I mean, yeah, how we come from here to here, this really just only to illustrate the idea. Yeah, but it's the equivalent to that one. Okay, and now this here is our error term, yeah, just described differently. And now minimization means, yeah, if you want to compute a minimum, you usually look at the place, at the position where the derivative becomes zero. Yeah, that's what you probably learned in school. Yeah, a minimum always has, for a smooth function, always has the property that the gradient or the derivative at that position is zero. So we have to compute the derivative of that one. That means this constant term here, yeah, drops. That one here has this delta u in, so what remains as derivative is 2atb, and deriving that one leads to that formula. And if we set that to zero, we come to that formula here. ATA delta U equals ATB. Yeah? And that means, yeah, we only have to find the delta U for which this equation here holds. And just to remember, A is given, A is that Jacobian, yeah? And A is big, but ATA is only a 2x2 matrix. Yeah, so we have to compute a large product, but in the end we get a 2x2 matrix. And this is a 2D vector, so in the end we only have to solve a 2D equation system to get the optimal value for delta U. Oh, okay, now you saw all features of my fancy new presenter. yeah, so what it boils down in the end is that simple linear equation system. Yeah, in order to minimize that one, sorry, in order to compute or to solve that problem here, yeah, we only have to compute that matrix and that vector and then solve a 2x2 equation. And that's what I said in the very beginning. The sum of squared differences has the nice property, yeah, or this only works because we use this sum of squared differences here. Yeah, if we use something more complicated, it doesn't work so nicely. It still works. Yeah, it makes things a little bit more complicated, but this simple approach here works for sums of squared differences, yeah, because here the 2 appears, and only then the derivative here, or we can do this derivation here. Yeah, but you see, yeah, it sounds like it's a very complicated approach, and in the end we can really find a very simple, or rather simple solution for that, and compute a value for delta U that then even further reduces the error and minimizes the error even further. And now we have to be, okay, I'm still thinking why. This is, in the simple shape I've described it up to now, it would be linear, but it is not linear because our function here is not really linear. Yeah, we approximate it by a linear one, but when going to the right or to the left, yeah, we don't have it's not linear at that point here. So we have to iterate that process, and this is what we see here. Yeah, so we have a starting value of u, and then we iterate that process a few times. We compute the Jacobian matrix. Yeah, that's this A. We compute the residual. Yeah, we solve for that delta u. Yeah, and now we update our u vector by delta u. And in fact, in such iterative methods, usually we do not immediately update by delta u, but only by a fraction. Yeah, so that we converge against the real result. Yeah, so that we don't make two big steps that maybe even bring us out of a pixel. Yeah, we slowly walk a little bit into that direction, or slowly, I mean, delta u alpha, something like 0.5 makes sense, yeah? And we iterate that a few times to really come to our minimum. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's a scheme that we will use very, very often and in many different contexts. So probably you will see that more often again. Okay, good. So now we have, let's briefly go back. So what do we have now? What have we learned? We have two images, yeah? We only want to compute the relative translation between the two images so that in the overlap region they are as similar as possible. Yeah, that's the very much simplified problem that we had up to now. Yeah, so we are looking for how do I have to translate the one image so that in the overlap it's as similar as possible with the other one. And we saw that we can do that on an image pyramid, yeah, so that we can get the large steps, yeah. So on the coarsest image, we find the large steps with the finer images, yeah. We become finer and finer, and in the end, we even do a subpixel optimization, yeah. So now we really have a perfect, almost perfect overlap between the two, if it's there. I mean, if you take an image of a car and of a house, yeah, that have nothing in common, then it probably also finds some minimum, but that doesn't make sense, yeah. But if there is a match, we hope that we can find it. Okay, but mainly that was for illustration purposes, yeah, to explain the general technique, because in practice, yeah, now you will run into problems. So one example is here. Here we have two pictures of a blackboard, and maybe you've even seen that there are applications that you can take multiple pictures, yeah, like panoramas, and then these are stitched together to a larger one. Yeah, and of course, as I described up to now, that sounds like it would be a solution for that. So I took two pictures of a blackboard, yeah, and you see here this dark piece here becomes visible here, yeah. So there's a significant amount of overlap. Yeah, so we can try and use our approach that we had before, yeah, and we will maybe end up here. Yeah, this now makes the alignment rather good here. But you will see that here in the top, it doesn't work anymore. And the reason, yeah, here it doesn't fit very well. Yeah, if we go back. In that example, it works pretty well. Okay. Now I'm confused with these. Here I am. But there are other examples, yeah, and that's another example now. Here I rotated the camera in between, and you see that we need to rotate the second image so that they fit perfectly. Yeah, I just moved here and then rotated a little bit and then took the second picture. Yeah, so we should not only optimize for a translation in that example, but also for a rotation. Yeah, a rotation in image space. So can we extend it in that direction? Of course we can, yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have shown the example. So in fact we do exactly the same like before, but it's just that here the transformation of our points, yeah, should be described differently. Yeah, so we do not only have a translation, but also here a rotation applied. Yeah, and this R is a matrix that rotates by some angle theta. Yeah, it's a 2x2 matrix. And it performs this rotation. And now all the differences, we do not only have to optimize for U, but also for the optimal phi, for the optimal rotation angle. Yeah. So instead of having a 2D optimization problem, we now have a 3D optimization problem. Okay. But otherwise, yeah, everything we've shown before still works. And before I show how, we can make things even more complicated. So what I did in this example is that I photographed the left half of the blackboard or of the whiteboard, yeah? And then I didn't move the camera like this, but I just took that picture and that picture. So I rotated the camera in between, and not in that direction, but in that direction. And as a result, yeah, you see that we get an image distortion, yeah? So here, this side is smaller than this side, yeah? And here we have, due to perspective, yeah, it's the picture of our blackboard is not rectangular anymore. And now if we want to match these two, yeah, this becomes much more complicated. Yeah, you cannot merge or stitch these two with only translations and rotations. You have to do something more complicated. Yeah, you have to undistort these images and map them to rectangles, maybe even scale them until we can match them. And in fact, this is what you need for for panorama stitching, yeah, because for a panorama, explicitly you should not walk, you should rotate around your camera when you take a panorama, and then you will always have this effect. Yeah, so to stitch these images, you need something more complicated. Yeah, you need to sort of undo the perspective distortion before. And I won't go much into details for that. One possible way would be to mark points on both images that obviously belong to each other. You need four of these, yeah, just four corresponding points. You need four of these, and then we can undistort these images and can merge them. And in fact, what this in the end is a perspective general projective transformation between the two images. Yeah. So as we here before, our transformation was a rotation and a translation. Yeah. So that's a rigid transformation. I think in the beginning you also spoke about different types of transformations. Now here to stitch these, yeah, you need a 8 degrees of freedom projective mapping, a real with homogeneous coordinates, ideally a 3x3 matrix that maps from here to here. Yeah, so the problem is still exactly the same. Yeah, but now it has 8 degrees of freedom instead of 2 as we had in the beginning. Yeah, and here are other possibilities. So we started with simple translation, but we can also allow fine mappings in between, maybe even perspective mappings or only 3D rotations. Yeah, then we have a little bit less degrees of freedom to describe the mapping between the two images. Everything stays the same as we had before. The only difference now is that when before we were always optimizing for this delta U here, yeah, or we do exactly this Lucas Canale approach, but instead of optimizing for delta U, yeah, now we have to optimize for a set or a change of the set of parameters of our transformations. So this delta P, for instance, could contain a translation and a rotation angle. Yeah, or it contains the full matrix of a projective mapping or whatsoever. Yeah. And now we have to find the delta P that minimizes this difference. And the mechanism as before is exactly the same. The only difference is that our Jacobian now contains, first of all, the gradient from the image, and then also the gradient that comes from this motion model. Yeah, so it's the chain rule that we have to apply to compute that Jacobian that directly translates a change of parameters into a change in brightness values in our image. Yeah. And for that, you need that chain rule. And in fact, yeah, here you even have a table that tells you for the different models, yeah, how the corresponding Jacobian matrices look like that you can then use, yeah, to compute your Jacobian. Yeah, and here you see how these matrices look like. Okay, good. So essentially, what here I wanted to arrive at is, okay, we in the very beginning we said we have that very example only translation, yeah. Now we already made more complicated deformations possible, but in fact, what in the end we want to have is per pixel a single flow vector, a single motion vector, yeah, for every pixel. Okay, and now let's try to do that, to write that down. Yeah. Now the problem is we do not only have to look for a single U value, but we have to look for such a U value for every pixel. Yeah. So instead of looking for one translation, we look for 1 million translations. And we want to find such values, yeah, such that this difference now is minimized. And now the only difference to what we did before is that this U has an index I. So this U now is for every pixel. And of course, if we look at that, yeah, we will see that this is not a reasonable way to describe the problem. Because what that says is for every pixel, we look for an offset so that we find somewhere another pixel that has the same color. And if we say we only have 256 different colors, yeah, that means I have a pixel with color 122. Somewhere else in the image, there's another pixel with 122. So I assume they correspond. And of course, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, this will be a rather random field of motion vectors. Yeah, because it just associates points that happen to have the same color. And it's very, very unlikely that they really belong to the same point. Yeah, if you have an image with 1 million pixels and you have 255 different colors, yeah, then there are, from every color, you have at least 10,000 pixels or so available that you can select from. Yeah, so this doesn't make sense. Okay, so we sort of also have to look at the neighborhood. Yeah, that's essentially the point. I cannot only say these two points correspond because they have the same color, but I could say they correspond because they have the same color and their neighborhood also. Yeah, and their neighborhood looks similar. And now this is what is called the patch-based approach. Yeah, and in fact, we do the same as we did before, that we compute motion vectors between images, but we don't do that on the entire image, but we subdivide our image into little patches and we do that patch-wise. Yeah, so this gives us already a kind of motion field on a coarse scale. Yeah. And then we try to compute the motion field from that. Yeah, and spread that to the entire image. And now we have the problem. Of course, it would make sense to take a large neighborhood, yeah, because that really then guarantees us, or if we find similar patches, yeah, then we can say they are very likely the same. But on the other hand, from image to image, yeah, also such a patch can change. And at some point, if the patch is too large, yeah, then they won't be identified anymore. So we have to find a compromise. And another problem is that this patch size, yeah, it's maybe not the same for all parts of our image. So if we, for instance, look at that patch here, now here you see such a patch, yeah, which is whatever, 10 by 10 pixels large, yeah, that would be a typical size. Yeah, this shows sky, yeah, and in fact, it's rather uniform. So what you will essentially see in that patch is noise from the image sensor, yeah? And it is very, very unclear, yeah, if we compare these two images, sorry that they are moving, yeah? So was it in the original image here, or here, or here? They all look the same, yeah? If we are on an edge, yeah, we can pretty well identify movements in this direction, but not in the direction along the edge, yeah? So some patch here looks very same to that one, very similar, yeah? But in that direction, we can quickly identify when we get away. And for which it works perfect is here such textured regions, yeah? Like this flower bed here, yeah? So here, movements in all directions can be very well detected. And this can be well described looking at what is here called SSD surfaces. Yeah, SSD stands for sum of squared differences. So if we take a patch, yeah, and compute how the similarity of that patch with itself, if we move it by certain directions, we will see that something like this here, yeah, where we have a clear feature, and I mean, in fact, now we are back at feature detection where you already learned quite a bit, yeah? So this is a point feature, yeah? And now if we translate the patch and compute the correlation or whatever, the error with itself, yeah? In any direction we go, yeah, we get a large error. So this one we can really identify very well its position. Yeah, here we have such a valley. And now if we go along that valley, they all look very similar, yeah? So this only works in one direction well, and if we have something unstructured, yeah, you see, yeah, there's not really possible to identify these similarities. Okay, so yeah, we should be clear about that. Okay, so where are we now? Yeah, we said okay, we compare two images, or we estimate the. So we have two images. Yeah, now we want to compute the optical flow for that pixel. So we look at a neighborhood and we try to find, yeah, here in the surrounding, we try to find that exactly same neighborhood. Yeah, and if sort of we find that patch again here, yeah, we say that this is the optical flow for that pixel. Yeah, and that we can do that for all the pixels we are interested in. Yeah, we always look at the neighborhood and search that neighborhood in the other image. So maybe here we find it here. Yeah, so this is the optical flow. Okay. Good. And now, as I said, the larger these patches, yeah, the more work we have to do. But the larger is also the danger that we don't find that complete neighborhood, yeah, that because something, whatever, a new object appears, and so from here on the patch looks different. Yeah, so we have to find a good compromise. And another point. Okay, good. Yeah, so much on patch based. Another possibility would be the following. And that's here now, the regularization-based optical flow. I told you that, let's go away from patch-based. I told you that just saying, okay, this pixel has some color. Yeah, I'm looking for another pixel that has the same color, so I associate them. Yeah, this is problematic because there are many, many pixels that do have exactly the same color. Yeah, so I can only choose one random one, essentially. Yeah. Okay, but what I could do is the following. I say, okay, if I look at neighboring pixels, I try to associate them with pixels of the same color and with pixels, yeah, that are next to the target of my neighbor pixels. So I look at these UI values, yeah, these vectors. So this one goes here. So favorably for the neighbor pixel, I would say this one goes here. And for that neighbor, it should go here, yeah? So essentially what I want is that these UI of neighboring pixels are roughly the same. Yeah, I want to say, okay, I have this general equation here, yeah, which doesn't really make sense, but I now add a term so that the UI of neighbors are preferably the same. And this is what we call regularization. We extend our term here, so that's exactly the term as above, and now we add a term, yeah, that prefers smooth UI values or UI values that are the same for neighboring pixels. And in that example here, that is made in a very similar form, we simply compute the gradient of the UIs, and if neighboring UIs are the same, then this gradient is zero. And if they differ, the gradient becomes large. So we simply add this gradient here, yeah, weighted by some factor alpha squared. And if we minimize that now, we get a reasonable result, yeah, because now, yeah, ideally all these UIs are the same, but of course that cannot always happen, so it's allowed that the UI changes, but the alpha sort of regularizes, how much the UIs can change versus how good the matches must be. Yeah, and so we get a solution where the flow is constant over large regions and it still maps corresponding pixels. Yeah, so that's another way to enforce that we also look at neighbors, just by this regularization. And an alternative way is not to add the gradient of UI, but here also the curvature of UI. Yeah. So this is just the second derivative of U, which is also added here, and it does essentially the same. Yeah. Okay, yeah, now we just have an optimization approach with a slightly more complicated energy, and it can be solved with the means that you learned before, but it also computes a good result. And I know I'm a little bit over time, but please excuse. Yeah, I will come back to that later, that I will compensate for that. Okay, and finally, another approach, now a third approach, would be that we compute a layer-based optical flow. And here the idea is the following. In practice, when computing optical flow, it makes sense to assume that we have layers in our image, like here. Yeah, so this tree trunk is one layer. And within that layer, we have a constant movement, but layers can move relative to each other. Yeah. So ideally, we should find a segmentation of our image where there's this tree trunk, for instance, separated from the background, and then we can separately compute the optical flow for these different layers. Yeah. And this does not always work, but it's a typical scenario. So such a scene would be a good scenario where this works nicely. Yeah. And this is called layer-based optical flow. So we somehow have to segment our scene into layers. And there's a nice way to visualize that. If we look at a single line of our little movie, now in that case we only have two frames. But if we take a complete movie and look at this line and we stack the lines on top of each other, we get such an image. Yeah, so that's the frames. This direction is the frames of that movie. And here we can see clear structures. So this here is the tree trunk in the front. And you see it moves faster than the other parts in the scene. Yeah. And in that image, it's nice to see the different layers, yeah, because that has a different speed than the other ones. And here this flower bed is also closer, so this becomes here the slope is still different than here for the background, but it's not as dramatic as for the tree trunk. So this can be used to iteratively generate these layers. So what we could do is that we compute the optical flow, for instance, patch based on a coarse grid. Yeah. And from that we generate layers. Yeah. We put all objects together that share their motion vector. Yeah. And then we have a first estimate for the layers. We compute the motion vectors for these layers and refine that continuously. Yeah. Across the entire animation. And in the end, we get a set of final layers, yeah, that is valid for all the animations, yeah, and for which we have within each of these layers, we have a rather constant motion vector. I mean, there are lots of algorithmic details in there, I don't have the slides for that, and we don't have the time for it, but you see, there are several papers, yeah, that approve upon this refinement, how that can be done better and so forth. Yeah, but that's also an alternative, that we don't really compute the motion vectors per pixel, but that we segment the image into layers and compute the motion vectors per layer. Okay, so that's what I wanted to speak about today. Sorry for being a little bit late. Two announcements. One announcement. Next week, I would like to add a little demo session. So PhD students of mine will show you systems, 3D vision systems, live in action, so to say. What we will show you is three systems that generate model reconstructions of 3D scenes. So essentially, these are systems that we will speak about in the lecture later on, afterwards. But nevertheless, it was a good moment to do that, and I think maybe it is also good that you see such systems running and you have an idea. When I then finally explain all the details, how they work in practice. So next week is demo session. I hope it's also fun. Maybe you can think of some interesting object you would like to have a 3D model of. So if you want to challenge them, bring something with you, and we can try to make a 3D reconstruction of that. So much for today and for next week. And sorry for being late, and we will see you again the next week. Thank you.